Wing Commander Roberts, Real 4. We were talking about your time at Bleeder, operating mainly against Berserker, but several other times. Yeah. Are there any specific incidents you remember from your operations during this period?
Well, there was one occasion when I caused a fire on the docks in Berserker, which, in other words, was a target I finally hit. Whether we ever did any other damage or not, I don't know. But anyway, well, that was an occasion when I, in fact, I got a signal in the book there. A copy of the signal confirmed it.
It was altogether much easier to concentrate, to be accurate.
Oh, absolutely.
Bombing from such a low height without opposition.
Yes.
Would that be the case?
Yes. Yeah.
And anything else during this time?
There's that signal, you see.
This will be deposited at the RAF Museum, Hendon. They can check things out there separately. Any other particular raids you remember?
There was one occasion when I wasn't on the roster for the night, but when the crews had been briefed, I was asked to volunteer for another job, which was dropping food. I don't know whether food and ammunition, but certainly a food, I think. I think it was a French unit supposed to be surrounded by the enemy, somewhere up in Tunisia. And myself and another crew went, found a pinpoint on the coast, did a run in to where we expected to see light signals on the ground, didn't see anything, and went back to a pinpoint on the coast, did another run. And we were just about to decide that we couldn't see what we were doing when there was a burst of flak on the right, which later I realised was quite a long way away. But at the same time, my control column started oscillating. I've never had an experience like that before. I had no idea what the problem was. So we dropped our load and set off for home, and all the way home, constantly my control column was oscillating.
Which meant, what effect did that have on the plane?
Well, it was quick enough not to have any real effect.
But nerve.
But otherwise, it would have. Well, I didn't know what the problem was. No idea, no experience of what was happening. Anyway, so going into land was a bit. I thought going to be a bit difficult. But anyway, as we slowed down, the oscillating stopped or slowed down, and we did a normal landing, no problems. And then we discovered what had happened. Out on the wing, there was a filler cap for petrol, and it was covered with a flap. Now, the flap had come loose and was drawn up by the vacuum over the top of the wing, so disturbed the overflow, which made the aeroplane oscillate. But that was very worrying for a couple of hours. Another occasion, at the briefing, we had a new commanding general, Northwest African Air Forces, new commanding general who was Jimmy Doolittle. Now, Jimmy Doolittle, of course, was a famous name, having taken off from carriers in the Pacific and bombed Japan. Anyway, Jimmy Doolittle was there at the briefing, and he asked to go on a trip, see? Well, I'm in Bomber Command, to take a passenger was a kiss of death. Anyway, I volunteered to take Jimmy. We got to Berserker and did our job. But he pestering me all the time to fly the aircraft. So I kept him off until half an hour out of Berserker going home when it got light. Put him in the seat and he was busy flying, no trouble at all. The starboard engine stopped, as it had done on two other occasions. Well, this time a bit more clued. What happened at Gibraltar was that when you turned on Ballast B, that was all right, fed the fuel across, but you got an airlock. Now, this time we're a bit more crude, and poor old general, I leaned over and did the the trimming wheel for him. But anyway, it didn't take a few minutes to get home. We flew home again, and it was all right. But that was unfortunate for him. But anyway, they changed the carburetor, and the aircraft was all right thereafter. My last trip was when the Germans were approaching from the south, you know, when getting towards the end in Tunisia. And I was given the job, and I think one or two other people were, of going up and down the road south of, well south of Tunis, towards Sfax, I think, going up and down the road and bombing and machine gunning anything we saw. But in fact, we didn't see anything at all, I don't think, which was a bit odd. But my rear gunner didn't turn up for the flight. And why he never did, I don't know, because I never saw him again. So whether he'd been caught in Algiers without transport or caught up with some woman or what, I don't know. But anyway, he was court-martialed. But it was the only time he might have fired the guns. I don't think.
What about recreations? Because I mean, you've got a bit in here about how you went to a rest camp. I don't know whether you could come. I mean, what did you do to during your time off?
Well, we didn't have any time off except we did somewhere in the middle. We decided we'd be going so hard that we'd take a few days off, and we got the rest of the crews down, but another captain and I decided to do something different because we had been invited to a house in Algiers where the press corps were billeted and where they were living. And we managed to borrow the CO's Humber brake, went down to the press corps, and they said, oh, we could just do with a Humber brake, so you can have our 1500 weight truck, which we got, and found a couple of two wrens and took them out for the night. And then the next night we got round to Wren officers. There were 15 beautiful Wren officers in Algiers, and we drove them all the way up. Beyond Blida, by a few miles, was a 5,000-foot mountain. And we went all the way up to the top and had a French omelette, the best one I've ever had in my life, I think. And we also went down the coast and did a bit of bathing on that short swim. Then there was a message from the squadron commander, where's my Humber brake? What are you doing? Why aren't you here? Anyway, we went back, and my friend was a bit senior to me. He stood to attention. I stood a little behind him to attention, and we were told off by the squadron commander.
What did you think of the squadron commander? Do you remember his name?
Now, he was somewhat older. I mean, I told you that the squadron commander we brought out from England went straight back, so we were a little while without a squadron commander. And the man we got, you remember, I think it was Sinclair, who was the squadron commander of the Bisleys in forward in Tunisia, which were practically the whole squadron was shot down, and Sinclair got the VC, I think. Well, I think one of the chaps who'd been involved in that, who was a wing commander, was sent down to us, and he's a bit older than some. I wouldn't make any comment really on him. I was fortunate in a sense, in that having been just commissioned, I flew out there as a pilot officer, and 6 months after becoming a pilot officer, of course, I was automatically promoted to flying officer, and 5 days later I was promoted acting left flight lieutenant because there was a vacancy on the squadron. So I got up to two rings very quickly.
Did you get on well with the other officers generally?
I didn't have any trouble. The only trouble I had was when I got my DFC.
And was that while you were out there?
Yeah. And the trouble then was because I pinched the DFC ribbon off an absent officer's uniform. because there was an all-round an all-round dance that night, to which I had a nurse coming, a lovely girl. So I wanted to have my DFC on my chest. So the chap came back, found he hadn't have a ribbon, and I got an awful telling off. But I sewed it back on for him.
And again, this was the award based on a period of service or any particular action?
No, it was the same as the last one. Suddenly a rash of gongs arrived, and I got one of them.
Were you very proud of your medals at the time?
Yes. Very glamorous making.
So what happened next then? I mean, this was your second tour. Well, it seems to have finished in May 1943.
Yes, well, as it happened, it finished at a time when the squadron moved. The squadron moved up to Tunisia, and instead of going to a camp, what do you call them, a transit camp, I was left at Bleda. And being a curious chap, I looked around and I found there were four Hurricanes. So I thought, well, why don't I fly a Hurricane? And they were there for two reasons. I think one was to help the press corps with dispatches from Tunisia, and the other was to provide the squadron commander of number 500 squadron, a Canadian, with transport to his various detachments. That was a Hudson squadron. There were two Hudson squadrons at Bleda. One was a man called Spotswood, who became an air marshal, I think, in due course.
Then you got several flights in them. What were they like to fly?
I flew all four. Very nice aeroplane, which I think preferred to the Spitfire, which was comes later. But and I flew all four, and in fact fired the guns at a rock in the sea.
Did you find you were easily able to cope? I mean, they'd worried about you as a single-seater fighter, and you'd obviously worried about it as well.
if I look back now, I wonder how I had the trepidation. And the man who authorised me to fly him, I don't know what his sense of responsibility was, I don't know.
But you just did it.
Yeah. And then eventually came orders to go home to UK. And that was unusual too, because an army major and I were detailed with guns around our waist to escort Field Marshal Messer, who was the chief Italian general in Tunisia, and I think a couple of generals and an aide-de-camp, home. And it was very funny because we were all put in a Dakota with other people, and we flew to Iran, and we stopped for lunch. And nobody appeared to look after these generals and things. I mean, they just came along with us and they had lunch with us. then we went off to Gibraltar, where things were rather different because we were surrounded with soldiers pointing rifles at us. And we stayed the night there. We stayed the night on a bit of a day, I think, because we took off the next day for Hendon in the dark. Blacked out aeroplane, of course, because there were Junkers 88s in the Bay of Biscay. And we arrived at Hendon about 9 o'clock on a beautiful summer's morning when the Field Marshal and the generals were taken off our hands.
What did you think of it? I mean, what did you think of it? Any chance to talk to him? Different languages? No real contact.
They were just other people.
So what happened when you got back then?
Well, I was given some leave, 2 weeks leave, and then ordered to report to Air Ministry for a new posting, which I did. Report to Air Ministry for new posting. I was asked what I wanted to do, and I said, well, anything. Except go to an OTU. So what happened? I went to an OTU, but it was one with a difference, because it was just forming, and was to be a transport OTU for training transport pilots. During the war, transport came out of nothing, developed out of nothing into what was a very large force at the end of the war. And this was a step in the process. But it meant going back to Wellington One Seas, which is an awful business, but I didn't have much trouble there.
Tell me about training the transport. I mean, were you training them right through, or was it were you just converting them?
Well, it was an operational training unit.
So you were just putting they'd already learned to fly.
Oh yes, well, already experienced people. Some South Africans, in fact, we had a great variety of experienced people.
Now you started there. This was a 105 operational training unit at Bramcote.
That's right.
And you were there from June 43 through to March 44.
Well, a bit more than that, I think. Well, at Bramcote, because we then moved over to a new satellite, Nuneaton.
Indeed, and then stayed out till November. Sorry, I should have seen that. Yeah,
and we got some Wellington 10s, which were a bit of improvement on the 3. Later got some Dakotas, and I think it was converted to Dakotas completely after I left. So I learned to fly a Dakota there as well.
What about the? Let's have a look at these. Both these. What about the Wellington 10? How was it better than the?
Well, because we never operated with a load, so it was much lighter, and it had an improved Hercules engine, I think, with a spinner, which the 3 didn't have. So it was a very lively aircraft.
And what about the Dakota? It's such a famous aircraft. What did you think of it as a transport aircraft?
Well, I suppose it was very useful as a transport aircraft, as a lorry, but then it behaved like a lorry.
not a pleasure to fly, then?
Oh, well, it was all right, but I mean, it didn't have any great. It didn't have any great faults. In fact, we have one occasion much later, which you'll hear about. But it was difficult to do a 3-point landing, so you had to do a wheeler with it.
Now, anything happened during? I mean, you know, you're just basically training, aren't you? Really? I mean,
I went to try and improve my category of a flying instructor. Back to number one flying instructor school. And when I landed in a Wellington, who stepped forward as my examiner but the chap who disliked me? So I knew I'd failed before I started. And when he said, well, now demonstrate a stall off a steep turn, I wasn't a very happy chap in an Oxford. So I failed that one.
Now, what about, you said you did some RAF administration. Now, in the post-war years, I presume you had to do a fair bit of this, but this was the first time you'd done some of it, acting as orderly officer, court-martials, courts of inquiry. First thing, I mean, what was the job of an orderly officer then on an RAF station?
Well, there were certain specified tasks which required you walk around the station and appear at certain times. Including, for instance, going into the sergeant's mess or the airman's mess and making inquiries to whether any complaints. I can't remember I can't remember anything else about it at all.
And what about the court martial?
Court martial was in Northern Ireland, and it had to do with a fracas that occurred in a pub when certain people were hit or what have you. And I think that chap went to the grass house for 9 months. That was pretty tough.
And what was your role in?
I was one of the judges on the court martial.
Had you had any specialist training, or was it just a matter of common sense and applying RAF regulations?
I think that's true. I think that's true. I did a court of inquiry or two. I remember one was a Wellington that went on fire while being refueled. I don't recall anything else at the moment.
So,
I did. While I was there, I did an administrative course, which later, much later after the war, was expanded at Bertram Newton to a 3-month course. But I did it 2 weeks in the far north of Scotland, very snowy, including going on the stage to conduct a commanding officer's disciplinary hearing in front of 50 others. Not very difficult to do that.
Anything else about your time?
Well, there was one occasion at Nuneaton when we had cloud, solid cloud at 500 feet, but we were used to the Spitfires being built at, across at Bromwich, doing terminal dives on test. And one terminal dive we heard, and it didn't stop. It kept on coming until we all ducked, and he went straight in the middle of the airfield, unseen. And I don't know how many feet he was buried, but that was it. You know, no, I don't know whether anyone picked them out or just left them there. But as a result of that, I was invited to go across to West Bromwich to have lunch with the test pilots and been shown round the factory, which was very interesting. And I took a solo Wellington 10 over and did what I shouldn't have done coming home, and flew the Wellington 10 loaded with gin, I think.
Why did you go to the Spitfire factory? Was there any military reason?
No, I was just invited. It was an invitation for, because I presume looked after some chaps from the factory when they came over to Nuneaton. I don't recall anything else at all, anything special.
So the next thing was, you mentioned one thing about Northern Ireland, it's sort of slightly different, but you were posted in November 1944 to number 1332 Heavy Conversion Unit at Nutt's Corner.
Yes, well, you know, time had gone on and I'd been piling up flying hours and I'd done a lot of time at the OTU. So one started thinking, now, what do I do next before somebody posts me without knowing what I wanted to do next? So I thought, right, four engines now. I've done a lot on two engines, now four engines. And so I made this request known. Unfortunately, I was posted to Northern Ireland, to this heavy conversion unit, where I learnt to fly Stirlings. And later, Yorks there. I qualified on Yorks there and got an exceptional rating.
What were Stirlings and Yorks like to fly? I mean, and what were four engine aircraft? I mean, what difference did it make?
I don't know that it made any difference, really.
Why did you need a conversion course then?
Well, I suppose they're much bigger aircraft for a start, and you've got two and three engine flying, that sort of thing. But I don't know. Anyway. I forgot, when I was talking about Hamden's, it had a vicious failure. And that was that if you pushed the rudder too far on, it would go fully on and stay on. You couldn't move it. So the aircraft went into a flat spin. Now, on the Stirling, the same sort of thing happened with the Erlands. They would flick right over full, but you were able to get them back again. But they would flick over. If you put a certain amount on, they would then flick fully. But you could get them back again.
Was nothing ever done about that fault?
No.
So you were getting ready. Now, why had you decided to do this course? Were you looking to your next posting?
No, but I mean, as a professional pilot, one wanted to advance, and four engines were advancing from two.
Now, were you thinking of going back to an operational squadron? And were you thinking you'd be in transport command or bomber command? Or what did you think would happen?
Well, I was firmly in transport at that stage, which, of course, was a developing outfit. It was getting bigger and bigger all the time, and therefore there was scope, perhaps.
So your next posting... As a captain, apparently, was to 246 Squadron.
At home in the south.
That's a transport squadron, and that was in February 1945, and that was through to the end of the war, to July 1945, well, the end of the war in Europe.
Well, not altogether on that squadron. 246 was just converting to Yorks and had Liberators. And I managed to get a little duel on the Liberator, which was like flying a piece of lead, I think. When I was at Holmesy South on Yorks, I flew to Iceland, I flew to the Azores, I flew to Morocco, I think even to Libya. All transporting freight of one sort or another. But I hadn't been there more than a few months, and I was posted to 511 Squadron at Lynham.
Hang on. So your basic duty was you.
I was an airline captain.
The York would be loaded up.
Yeah.
You'd come along, get in it, and fly it to where it was going.
That's right.
And what crew would you have?
There were four crew: two pilots, a navigator, and a radio. Five, because a radio operator and an engineer.
And anything happened during this period?
No.
The end of the war. Do you remember VE Day? I mean, did you celebrate that at all?
VE Day.
8th of May.
Yes, I was not very far from here, in fact. What's the name of the place? Along towards Henley, on the south side of the river.
What did you do? Any special celebrations?
I was at a pub, staying the night.
And how did you celebrate?
Oh, I don't know. I think they were dancing in the streets. I don't know. I wasn't a great chap for celebrating.
How did you feel about it? I mean, you know, you've been in the war since the start.
Yeah.
Was it a sort of big thing to you, or were you a bit dulled by it all?
Well, I think the point was that here was one in a big operational force, which was still going on. The war hadn't finished. It had finished in Europe, but the war hadn't finished. And so, you know, the war just went on.